This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is the Book Riot Podcast. I'm Jeff O'Neill.
And I'm Rebecca Shinsky.
And we come to you on the eve of, in the run-up to the some numbereth Academy Awards. I should have looked that up. You know, this is
the 2024 Oscars. Let's go.
There you go. I like when they do like Super Bowl 78 or something like that. I'm sure they have whatever it is here. And we are going to talk about the most bookish of categories, of course, the adapted screenplay category. Rebecca and I have a special place in our hearts for movies, but also adapted screenplays because they are, of course, based on books. Rebecca has been movie focused over the last couple years. It seems
couple
like you've
years,
been more
yeah.
movie focused than I have, certainly of late, and even more than you have in the past. And I try to see, I'll see most of these eventually. I have seen three of the five nominees for adapted screenplay. Though I did just recently do a deep dive, two deep dives actually, mm-hmm. on past adapted screenplay winners over the last 20 years, and I ranked them from 20th to first. Did you have any grievances with that list? I know you read it and you took some notes,
yeah.
but did anything jump out to you as being completely wrong?
No.
Or was I mostly right as always?
You were mostly right. I didn't have a lot of big quibbles. I think if I yeah. spent, you know, some extended time with it, I would probably move some pieces around, you know, like mm-hmm. where you had a three, I might have had something in sixth or something like that. But the general vibe of the list I agreed with, and I enjoyed your commentary.
Yeah, so you can check that out in the show notes if you'd like to. And I think that's instructive. That is instructive for this because sometimes what wins is about things other than what's
yes.
the best one, right? And it's hard to know what the best one is. And, you know, sometimes I think that's all part of the mix. It's interesting to see some of these. I think maybe there's maybe next year I'll do a what should have won the adapted screenplay Oscar in each year.
Mm-hmm.
I thought about including that, but it was already getting away from me to the point where I broke it into two sections that I didn't need to do that. And so maybe one way we could look at this year's is what do we think will win, what should win, and maybe a if we could pick a winner. I mean, those may be three different ways of,
yeah.
of looking at it right
I
here.
Think- It's also interesting to let folks know, like, I was thinking about adapted from what? Like, usually it's
yep.
books. In the last 20 years, all but three of the winners have been adapted from literary works, and that includes books and plays. But it can be, as I grinched about on a previous episode, adapted from an existing concept, which is how Barbie is one of these
yep.
nominees, even if there's no real written material about that concept. And I learned when I was going back through all the nominees of the last 20 years that sequels of original screenplays become
right.
nominees for adapted screenplays. So like Before Sunset, which is the second in the Linklater trilogy, is nominated for best adapted screenplay because it is adapted from the concepts in Before Sunrise, which was an original.
Yep.
And so it gets a little tangly there. But for our purposes, you know, generally it's books and existing concepts. This year, the five are American Fiction, which is based on the novel Erasure by Percival Everett from 2001. Barbie, self-explanatory. Oppenheimer, based on American Prometheus by Kai Bird and Martin J. Sherwin from 2005. Poor Things, which is based on the novel by the same name of Alistair Gray from 1992. And then The Zone of Interest, which is based on the novel The Zone of Interest by Martin Amis, which is from 2014. So an interesting spread of mostly
yes.
not terribly recent literary material. The newest book is 10 years old here.
Yeah, and there's a meta thing that's even you know, the Academy is a corpus. It's a body of people. Mm-hmm. So there is no marching order to be given, right? There's no, it's just what they think is the best. And I wrestled this within my own ranking, like, is it what makes for the best movie, regardless of its fidelity or not to the underlying source material? Do you account for degree of difficulty? Do you account for, you know, things other than, you know, like adapted screenplay? 12 Years a Slave is what I was thinking about, because some of what McQueen does there, some of the reason that movie is so powerful is how it's shot. Mm-hmm. And it happened I don't mean to dismiss it by saying happened. It was also based on a kind of contentious memoir that was transcribed by a white person. Anyway, it's kind of an interesting story in itself. So what are we looking for here?
Yeah.
Because there's the faithful, we didn't screw it up. Is that more or less noteworthy than the example I used in that one I've used before, and I've used in Adaptation Nation, is something that frankly makes the underlying source material sing in a way that maybe it doesn't on its own. And Hunt for Red October is the one I use. I mean, this is not a great work of the Western or world cinema, but it is a hell of a screenplay achievement, because I read the book and I watched the movie and all the decisions they made to make that were smart and right and worked. Mm-hmm. And there's sort of a craftsmanship to it, an art to it. And those are two different words. As opposed to something like one of my favorite movies that's based on a book, and one of my sort of most beloved movies is Wonder Boys.
Yes.
Gus Van Sant. I don't know that he wrote the screenplay too, but based on Michael Chabon's Bond's novel. It's 25-year anniversary next year. We should put that one.
Oh, yeah. It's on the list.
But that one pretty much films the book and doesn't screw it up. Whereas something like Oppenheimer is doing something, I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure myself what to do with those. What do you think of that, Rebecca?
Yeah, I think there's two conversations to have. When we're talking about guessing what the Academy is going to do, I think we need to work from the assumption that that people are voting based on how good the movie is.
Right.
They're maybe considering, does this look like it was a difficult movie to make based on what they can glean from the material? Like, what is the level of difficulty? But we should assume that they are not familiar with the source material and they're not thinking about that at all. I don't think fidelity to source material is a primary factor here. I'm sure some of the Academy members have read some of these books. Maybe a few of them go out of their way.
A lot of unread American Prometheus is on Beverly Hills nightstands, I would think. Well, I guess I wasn't really thinking about sort of what we like for, because I think what we might do is I try to predict what will win, what maybe should win, and then what our personal favorite was, talk about some of the.
And for me, and I think you're in this camp, I want the movie to be good and to bring forth the subject matter in a way that's compelling and interesting and powerful and all of those things that we're looking for from art. Whether it's faithful to the details of the source text, I really don't care. I think we're looking for being in the spirit of the law rather than the letter of the law here. Does this convey the spirit of the work? And some of, as you were talking about, you know, Hunt for Red October, like Field of Dreams is a good example of that as well. The book, super not great. The movie like makes really smart choices about how to pull out some elements of a book and turn it into something. And it would lose for fidelity to source material. But fidelity to the source material is not always a good thing. So when I've been thinking about my own, what did I like? What do I think should win? What do I think will win? I really tried to just think about, you know, the experience of the film itself and what kind of accomplishment it is, what it contributes to American art and cinema. I haven't read, let's see. Four of these are based on books. I've only read Erasure that American Fiction is based on. I didn't read American Prometheus or Poor Things or The Zone of Interest. And American Fiction is relatively faithful. But I also don't really think that matters. So that's where I'm at. Like, I care that the movie is good. I think that's the first place the Academy comes down as well. Like, just was this good? Is it meaningful? And then you get into some of those weirdnesses that we'll get into later, where maybe sometimes like a film wins because that filmmaker has been shut out of other things and people think like it's just time, or a film is shut out of other categories and this is the place where voters think that they can give it a nod. And I think there's the possibility for some of that to be going on with these.
I am torn about the fidelity thing. With fiction, I don't mind, right? It's an adaptation. It's an interpretation. please do not use my rankings against me because I go against my own heart here. When we're messing with biography and real life events, I have a harder time. Now,
oh, that's fair.
We famously between us differed on Dickinson, right?
Yes.
Because I'm like, Emily's interesting enough. Why do we have to do this song and dance and pizzazz? On the other hand, if you like it, you like it. My fear about that is that it becomes then the de facto historical record because movie cultures are so much bigger than biography. And the lesser known, the worse it can be. So, you know, something like, well, frankly, The Social Network's a really good example. Sorkin did a lot of stuff to make a great movie, to write a great screenplay, and Fincher made a great movie. And it's a wonderful all-timer of a movie.
It's a great movie.
Is it about Facebook anymore? I'm not sure.
No.
I called it in the deep dive, it's more of a The Godfather of Silicon Valley, which I think is that kind of function. It's amazing. But it's not really the story of Facebook in a lot of ways.
I think what you're kind of getting to there is that adaptation can mean so many things.
So many things. That's
and
right.
We've talked in the past about maybe making a distinction between adapted from and like a transformation rather than an adaptation. And I think Dickinson is a transformation where like it's also dialed up enough that it's pretty clear the makers of that show are not trying to tell you like this is the canonical story of Emily Dickinson's life. You know, like Wiz Khalifa shows up driving a carriage. So you know the like kind of realm of silliness that you're living in there with some of the real grounded details from her story. But I take your point that if we're talking about Oppenheimer, like if Christopher Nolan goes and changes significant facts about Oppenheimer's story to make the movie more interesting, then we're in the land of this is a transformation of this book, and the Oscars don't get this granular to separate adaptations from other kinds of like inspired by works. But in the court of rightness, I would do that. I would separate this is an adaptation that's trying to be faithful to a book from this is something that takes nuggets or the center idea or character from a book and then builds off of it.
Yep. All right, let's do a break and get into the specifics of these nominees here.
Today's episode is brought to you by Bloom Books. Taming Seven is an epic and unforgettable love story in the international best-selling and TikTok phenomenon The Boys of Tommen series from Chloe Walsh. So Tommen's cheekiest lad, Jared Gibbsy Gibson, has always been a comedian, but inside he is haunted by events of the past and he uses humor to cope, hiding his true self from the world. Then you have Claire Biggs, who is the epitome of sunshine. She's always loved Gibbsy, her brother's friend and her favorite neighbor. She also has always seen a side to him that no one else seems to notice, and she becomes determined to tame her wild-at-heart childhood best friend. So the Boys of Tommen series is an internationally best-selling YA romance series that has taken TikTok by storm. It's perfect for readers looking for new adult / crossover romance, dual point of views, friends to lovers, marathon-worthy TikTok books, and angsty tearjerkers. Taming Seven is published today, and it's the fifth book in the series, so make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Bloom Books for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by KT Hoffman. The pressure cooker of minor league baseball leads to major chemistry in this exhilarating, sexy, and triumphant rivals to lovers debut romance. Gene Ionescu is the first openly trans player in professional baseball. He has nearly everything he's ever let himself dream of. That is, until Luis Estrada, Gene's former teammate and current rival, gets traded to the Beavers. Now, Gene and Luis can't manage a civil conversation off the field or a competent play on it, but in the close confines of dugout benches and roadie buses, they begrudgingly rediscover a comfortable rhythm. As the two grow closer, the tension between them turns electric and their chemistry spills past the confines of the stadium. So this is one of the first adult rom-coms published by a major publishing house centering a gay trans man by a gay trans man. It also has ADHD and anxiety representation and some joyful, heartfelt moments. Make sure to check it out. And thanks again to The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by KT Hoffman, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Amazon Publishing. Let me ask you a question. How well do you think you know people? And how well do you think they know you? Six award-winning, best-selling authors of suspense explore the lingering threat of secrets and the inescapable fear that they can't stay buried forever. So no matter how dark the hiding place, the consequences of revealing the truth can bring out the worst in lovers, friends, family, and strangers. And check this out. You can read and listen to all six short stories in the Never Tell collection free with Prime. You can learn more at amazon.com/nevertell. And these best-selling authors include Liv Constantine, Laurith Ann White, Andrea Bartz, Rachel Halsall Hall, Avi Pachota, and Carolyn Kepnes. Again, you can read and listen to all six short stories free with Prime and also Kindle Unlimited. So make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Amazon Publishing for sponsoring this episode.
Okay, so we've got five nominees. You went through them. How do you want to proceed from here, Rebecca? This is kind of your show. I'll cede to you.
Maybe just like quick overviews of them, and we can talk as we go through that about the ones we've seen and then get into our rankings. So American Fiction, it's based on Erasure by Percival Everett. It's about a black writer who does like very serious academic highbrow work, and he sees that the only black writers that get popular commercial success are the ones who tell stories that sort of feed into primarily white readers' ideas about stereotypical black life. Things like, you know, gangsters and drug addiction, like whatever it is that you're thinking of right now, that's also what he's picturing. Mm-hmm. He writes what he intends to be a satire that's like a super dialed up version of one of those stories, that he sends it off to his publisher thinking like, this is going to get them, like this will show them how absurd these things are. And what actually happens is his publisher does not see the satire at all, loves the book, thinks it's a commercial like bombshell. He gets a huge book deal. He gets a movie deal. He publishes the whole thing under a pseudonym, and then like chaos and shenanigans ensue while he's trying to keep his fake life as this author who has been in prison supposedly for maybe it was murder from his real life. And then woven through it, especially brought forward in the movie, is more of a family story as well. His mother is sick. His brother is going through stuff. His sister is also going through stuff, and he's navigating those things as well. I know we've both seen this one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's good on all counts. Kind of a classical, not in topic, but in form, adapt. It's like kind of the adapted screenplay. It's based on an interesting book. It's got interesting literary ideas. It's sort of highbrow, and actually very highbrow. Erasure by Percival Everett is probably as highbrow of a book. Well,
yes.
Martin Amis, I guess, in the same category. And Poor Things, a very strange book in a lot of ways. It is a very highbrow category this year, with Barbie in its own special place. Sometimes it can be, but like last year we had Top Gun, Knives Out, and then we had All Quiet on the Western Front, Ikiru, and you know, it's strange. It can be a very strange category, and it kind of becomes a holding pen for a lot of different things, because we discussed Barbie. I mean, I don't know what else we need to say about Barbie at this point, based on characters created by Ruth Landler. Maybe just get her name out there as the mm-hmm. movie tries to do as well. I think it's, you know, I said before, I think it's the right place to put this. Maybe one way of understanding my thing is like, if there is a box of stuff on the shelf that you pull off to make your movie, it's adapted. Now, that could be, in the case of Moonlight, an unproduced playlet is what Moonlight is based off.
Yeah, that's a weird one.
Very strange one. Or Barbie or Top Gun or existing characters, or if, you know, The Dark Knight, was that nominated for Best Screenplay? It probably was back in the day.
Yeah.
So I think a wonderful achievement, if anything. The degree of difficulty is higher because while you have characters, you don't have plot. And I think the people that don't particularly like Barbie here think of a ready-made plot as being as important as anything. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
That can go.
Yeah. I want to go back for a minute to like how highbrow Erasure is as a work of literature. It's not the highest of brows, but it's up there, and it's pretty sharp, pointed satire of the flavor where like, those are the, that's the zone where an author risks the preaching to the choir kind of audience. Like, you're not really going to pick up Erasure by Percival Everett if you know what it's about, unless you kind of already are on board with the argument that he is making. And they maintain the central premise of that, but it is a lot less sharp for the film. It's mainstreamed, yeah. Like, which is smart. Cord Jefferson made great decisions, I think, adapting that text for the screen so that it could be funny and it could be sharp, and it can, you can then invite people in. Like, the trailers make it look primarily like a family movie, and in a lot of ways it is, but that invites people in and grows the audience, who then, it's not quite the like burying your dog's pills in a piece of cheese, like sneaking the message in, but it's a version of that, that by, you know, like, there are ways that this film, that American Fiction, could have looked like a lot more serious, a lot more self-serious, that would have prevented it from having such a wide audience. And it's the kind of message that, like, it goes down a little easier if it's a little fun to watch and if it's not just about racism, and I think they did a really nice job with that.
Oppenheimer, again, a giant totemic book, and story and character and subject material. The stakes get no higher. The combination of the cinematic nature of the atomic bomb trials, the pressure of the time, and the figure of Oppenheimer come together in ways you kind of can't believe it. If this was fiction, it wouldn't work, right? If you just made up a character and did this, the specter of realness, I think, lends credence a lot of times to stories like this. And also, that's why I think it can be hypocritical to, like, lend the gravitas of this is real and then screw with it.
Sure. Right?
And then screw with the stories of it. I think that's playing both sides, which I don't particularly like. Magisterial, I love this book. I love this movie. In some ways, it's, I don't know, maybe feels a little underrated even to me. I feel like in 10 years, I'm like, oh yeah, it should have been Oppenheimer, just for all the things. I'm kind of feeling that way today, but I've had a little distance since I've seen it now, which I didn't necessarily feel that time, but the expectations were so high because I had seen it at the very end. I only saw it like a couple weeks ago.
Okay.
So I don't know. I think in most years, Oppenheimer is the favorite and it's not close. Is my take on this.
Notable is that Killers of the Flower Moon is not in this category.
Thinking about, did we want to broach that can of worms? Like, what else should be here?
It's just in most of the other big categories, and it happens to be adapted from a literary work. I don't know that there's a whole lot to say there that doesn't take us down the rabbit holes about, like, the gossip about Academy politics.
Yeah. I mean, I guess we could say, would you swap it out for something yourself? Not having seen The Zone of Interest or read the book, it's hard. I kind of have to abstain there. So
yeah, I have not read The Zone of Interest. I'm going to have to ponder that. I don't know that what I would make a swap for here. That's a cinematic achievement. Yeah, in the math of how the Oscars go, like, Killers of the Flower Moon is a huge cinematic achievement. I think about on par with the cinematic achievement of Oppenheimer, and I think they're both going to take home plenty trophies. So, like, ultimately, it's probably fine that it's not here for screenplay. There are other places for that film and the writers and directors and actors to shine. I really enjoyed Barbie. I think Greta Gerwig did great things with that film, and it is hard to create a story out of nothing. I don't know. I don't want to give up Barbie here. I want to see Greta Gerwig get some kind of recognition and moment for it. But if you got to tack on a sixth, Killers of the Flower Moon would be it this year.
I mean, I reread the book and then watched the movie and thought the decisions were fascinating about foregrounding and backgrounding and moving basically the focus of the film around. And I do think it is a more interesting movie, what Scorsese did, than what Grand did initially. I can certainly see if you don't know, in the book, Jesse Plemons' character, is his name Tom Ford? Can that be right? He's the sheriff, like the guy that's like the proto, you know, he's the first FBI man, the first G-man, as far as we can tell, is very early in that. And Grant, I think, in I think the dad book move was to make that character the central character. I think it was right from selling hardcovers on Barnes and Noble's display tables. But I think it's a much more psychologically interesting book to have DiCaprio's character be the lens through which you see the whole thing.
Yeah. I think that's a nice microcosm of the divide between what works for a book in a highbrow way and what works for inviting a broader audience into a story.
Yeah, right. That's the way Gran chose to tell it as well. Like, that's another thing that you sometimes can be lost in. Well, it's based on history. Yeah, there's different ways of telling history. Like, that was a lens, too. That wasn't just like, he didn't just find that in the arc as Indiana Jones opened it. And that's just sort of the way things were. Like, he chose that particular lens as well.
The book was originally positioned as like the making of the FBI.
Yeah.
And that all of the, like, the real story there, the massacre of Native Americans, was like the backdrop against which the FBI was made.
Right. It was the MacGuffin. Right. The Osage was the MacGuffin of creation of the FBI, which is the crassest way of putting it, but there is an element to that.
Yeah. That's like one of the phrases from the original blurbs. So that after Oppenheimer brings us to Poor Things. I have not read this novel. I kind of wish I had. I just saw the movie over the weekend. It's like the way I've been trying to describe it to people, it's like a feminist steampunk flip on Frankenstein with a lot of sex. Emma Stone's character is created by a Dr. Frankenstein-esque dude that played by Willem Dafoe named Godwin Baxter, whose name gets shortened to God to like hilarious effect throughout the movie. He finds the body of a woman who has jumped off a bridge and she was pregnant at the time. She has not been dead long enough to be unuseful to him in his experiments. So he removes the baby from her uterus and transplants the infant's brain into her own dead body and then raises the woman child. Like, I don't even know how to come up with the terminology, who, like, it's an infant's brain, but, and you know, they don't get super into the details of like the biology here, but her name is Bella, and Bella grows up faster than, like, on an accelerated timeline mentally than a normal, like, you know, typically born child would, and is confined to their home. So all she really knows of like life and the world are the things that he tells her. She has like kind of no concept of like social behavior, no concept of what is polite or appropriate. And this makes her life very interesting and funny and then increasingly challenging for everyone around her as she discovers sexuality. Kind of gets seduced by a character that Mark Ruffalo plays. He thinks he's going to like have her all to himself, and they run off together, and she has appetite for not just him. She wants to do furious jumping with everyone that she can have access to. And I mean, it is hilarious. It has really sharp commentary around like how often the things that draw men to women become the things that make men hate those same women, and that how that results many times in a tension between like, I either want you all to myself or I will kill you. That is completely illogical, but very familiar. It's played, I mean, I thought this was wonderful. Emma Stone's performance is just stellar. It's super weird, but not so weird that you can't engage with it. There are great moments of comedic relief. And I've seen a lot of interesting, like, kind of arguing discourse commentary around, like, is this a feminist story or not? And I think it's, I mean, yes and no. Like, Bella's not held up as a feminist icon, but there is feminist commentary to be found in, like, what happens when a woman wants to exercise full agency over her body and enjoy sexuality and independence, and how men who wish to own or control that woman respond to it, what kind of danger there is, what kind of fear there is, what those behaviors look like. And because it's all wrapped up in this like colorful weirdo steampunk world, that goes down a lot easier too. But just, I mean, Emma Stone in this, I was really knocked out.
I'm looking forward to seeing this. One of the reasons I've been so excited to see it is I think the book is such a textual object that, and I don't know how much of that actually appears into it, because it's obviously based on, well, inspired by Frankenstein thematically, but structurally the text itself has documents within it. Like the main narrative is then followed by Bella's refutation of the whole thing. And then there's other documents after that by one Alistair Gray, who wrote the whole thing, of course.
Interesting.
And he's saying he's just editing the whole thing. And then there's documents from other people in the life. And then also blurbs on the book are fake.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Some of them are fake. And there's fragments of Grey's Anatomy in it. Like, it's about being literary, right, at some degree. So, again, you can't do that.
I should go back and read that.
I've read some writing about it. To adapt that, you would need to make the movie about movie making to some degree. You need some sort of frame story or you know, this kind of device goes back to Cervantes, who famously, I found this text that's by, about this guy in his market. But, this idea that it makes it more real if you present the text as found, assembled, real documents. So for me, it was it's a book of much about literary history and writing and authority and how we tell stories and what we believe. And I didn't see clearly the movie. Again, you have to make choices, but that seems completely stripped away as far as I can tell, having not seen the movie at all.
That's right. I had no idea that is the shape of the book until you said that just now. The closest that gets is that Bella doesn't know what her origin story is until pretty far into the movie. And she goes into God's lab and reads his notes and sees and understands then the procedure that he has performed on her.
Because in the book, if I remember right, the implication is that the thing he made up is not actually her body, but the story of her. And that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
I think that's really cool in its own way. So
that makes me want to
do that with what you will. It's not very long, I don't think. It won the Guardian Fiction Prize and the Whitbread Award in 92. I read this late in high school.
Maybe
I was not quite ready for this.
I can imagine not being ready for that as a teenager.
Yeah, it reminded me of Life and Opinions of Tristram Shandy. It's in this satirical, formally playful, strange, sort of highbrow, weird fiction of the British.
I would not have known what to do with that. My Kansas 16-year-old self would have not.
It's hard. What is happening?
Maybe we'll hold on to that and bring run it back as an Adaptation Nation around Halloween or something sometime. That would be fun.
Cool.
And the last one is The Zone of Interest, based on the novel by Martin Amis. The film is written and made by Jonathan Glazer. I've not read the book, but I have read a little bit about the ways the book is different from the movie. The movie is about Rudolf Hess, who was a real person. He was the commandant of Auschwitz, the concentration camp. He had spent his life working, or the recent years of his life, working his way up the corporate ladder of the Third Reich. He and his wife have 5 kids. They are living the dream in a beautiful house that was built for them and customized and has a gorgeous garden. And the neighbors come by and everyone is envious. And it is just over the wall from the concentration camp. And the whole film exists in and around their home. We never go into the camp, but you hear it. You see him taking meetings at home with someone who shows up to sell him a more efficient crematorium. You see we should probably throw a trigger warning at the top of this show. Spoiler warning and trigger warning stuff about anti-Semitic content here. It's difficult to watch, and that's the point, that you see his wife has her friends over so that they can go through the clothing that was taken from Jewish women who were delivered to the concentration camp, and they can pick what they want. Maybe they want a nice fur. At night, you hear shots. You can see the fire reflected from the crematoriums over the wall, and they are just intent on living their lives and having what they want, and him continuing to climb the ladder. It's horrifying. And that's the point of look at these monsters who are delighted in the life that they are living and look at how they have chosen to live it in order to have the things that they want. I understand that the book does similar stuff, but doesn't draw on a real person. And so Glazer made the choice to pluck Rudolf Hess out of history. He was eventually hanged for the crimes that he committed during the war. We don't get that far in the film, but it's this very quiet kind of feel. It kind of feels like watching Big Brother or The Real World, where the cameras are fixed in different places around right. the house, and you're just watching them go about their daily lives while you hear gunshots and shouting and the train coming through, with occasional little like glimpses of evidence of what's going on the other side of the wall, making its way into their daily lives. But just how, like, it's very explicit for them that they know what they're doing, and he wants to do it well so that he can keep climbing and they can keep having this lovely life. And it really drives home like the banal human evil of it all. It also feels very artsy. Like the thing I struggled with about the film is like, it's really powerful to watch how these people distance themselves from what they're doing so that they can, you know, try to maintain the life that they have. But the way the film is made distances you as the viewer from it as well. Mm. And I think that's become a controversial thing. Like he should have made it more horrifying. There's like weird stuff that happens where you'll zoom in on a flower and then the whole screen is just red for a little bit. The whole screen is black with like very quiet sound at the beginning, and I've heard that folks who went to see it were like, is the projector broken? Like, has the movie mm-hmm. not started yet? And that kind of artsiness combined with a story like this, I think makes it's tough. Like, it's a hard movie to watch and it's a tough sell. So that's the zone of interest.
I am terrified of this movie. I've read a bunch about it. I think it's a fantastic way of reframing something that's even mm-hmm. now too familiar, the Holocaust and Nazis.
Yeah.
And I think there's pieces of it that resonate with me that are not about this, you know, just to be personal for a second.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every time I walk past an unhoused person, I'm doing something not dissimilar. I mean, it differs in kind, but, you know, this is an extreme example of the turning away from the plausible deniability, the forgetting that damn near all of us do most of the time mm-hmm. to suffering and injustice and pain everywhere. This is perhaps the most extreme example you can think of, is literally being right next door and it's seemingly profiting from and rising directly in accordance with it. But I think the questions and the telescoping ramifications of those questions are more terrifying than the actual movie itself in a lot of ways. I mean, Holocaust is bad, don't forget, absolutely. I almost wonder, does that also put in its own kind of box? Well, it's easy to say, well, that's bad. And then say when you're driving home and there's a tent city under the bridge and you don't even think about it for a minute. You don't even see the parallel or connection.
That's a great point and a great question. And the way that it's shot, the way the story is told, it's like very clear that these people are the villains. These people are monsters. They're also just so objectively horrible. Like, there's a conversation where the wife's mother comes to visit and they're just like having casual chit chat about a Jewish woman who used to be their neighbor. And the mother's like, oh, I wonder if she's over there. I lost my bid in the neighborhood auction on like whatever, something that was in her house that was left behind because she was taken to the concentration camps. They're just, you know, it's so callous and so casual that it's pretty easy to distance yourself and your own daily dilemmas about the kinds of things you're talking about from how awful they are. The film, if it's intended to invite us to think about those smaller ways that we all turn from horror, I don't think it succeeds in that.
And I'm not interested in saying that someone who made a movie about the Holocaust and was trying to do something different with it should have done something else because Barbie is in this category, right? Like, I mean, it's like, you know, and Barbie's doing its own thing, but let's not compare. And American Fiction and Poor Things too, for that matter. So I don't want to ding Glazer in the movie for being not exactly the critique I would make, because I am not making a giant art house movie reminding people and sacrificing some commercial viability for an artistic vision. I applaud that in all ways.
Oh, yeah.
But having said that, what I've read is like, I found myself being drawn to a different interpretation than it seems like the movie is. I will see this eventually.
I think that's
by
right.
myself mm-hmm. on a plane, probably, when it's really awkward.
Oh my God. And, yeah. You terrible. And your like Dark Night of the Soul existential crisis movies in the middle of the night on planes. Yeah. Godspeed.
It's my same way of coping as say, well, I'm not going to tell that story. You know the story I'm thinking of. It's when I was thinking about productivity hacks in a situation I probably shouldn't have been.
That's a good one. We should save that for the Patreon.
It's a way of compartmentalizing,
sometime.
I think.
Yes. So, yeah.
Yeah. That will be the last Patreon episode, that particular story.
That's the mic drop.
Yeah, that's right. The way out. All right, let's do one more sponsor break, and then let's do what we think will win, what we should win, and any other things.
This episode is sponsored by The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy. Robbie and Trevor Cressmont have enough wealth to ensure they'll never be found guilty of any wrongdoing, even if everyone believes they're behind the deaths of their ex-girlfriends. Let us all take a collective angry sigh at that. Lauren O'Brien, the new girl at school, has a dark past of her own, and she's desperate for a fresh start. Except when she starts a relationship with Robbie, her chance is put in jeopardy. During what's meant to be their last weekend together, Lauren stumbles across evidence that might just implicate Robbie. And after a third death rocks the town, she must decide whether to end things with Robbie or risk becoming another cautionary tale. This is an edge-of-your-seat YA thriller that's perfect for fans of Karen McManus and Holly Jackson. Make sure you pick that up now wherever books are sold. And thank you once again to The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy for sponsoring today's show.
Today's episode is brought to you by Steve Aoki's Hero Quest at your local bookstore or online at herquest.com, and catch Steve live on the Heavenly Hell Tour. Hero Quest is a graphic novel that is the story of a genetically augmented metahuman named Hero who travels into the multiverse 400 years into the future to save Earth from a disaster it cannot avoid. It has everything from mutants to robots to zombies to aliens, witches, and more. It's a quest for 10 rings of tremendous power from 10 different worlds that will be needed to save our world from certain disaster. It's an epic journey that will require the hero named Hero to be cursed to save the lives of billions on Earth. It's a story of heroism, wonder, betrayal, and finally, revelation. This is the hero's journey. This is Hero's quest. So the story was imagined by the mind of Steve Aoki and written by New York Times bestselling author Jim Kruger and Steve Aoki. So make sure to check it out. And this episode comes thanks again to Steve Aoki's Hero Quest at your local bookstore or online at herquest.com, and catch Steve live on the Heavenly Hell Tour.
All right, I'll give you the chance. I'll give you the you won the coin flip. Would you like to give or to receive the kickoff here?
I will receive the kickoff.
I think Barbie is going to win.
Oh, say more about that.
I think it's, and we see this from time to time, that the adapted screenplay can be a pressure release valve for something people are interested in awarding. And the stakes seem lower than in an acting category or directing category. So it's like, yeah, we'll throw you a bone. Tarantino gets this in original screenplay, the bone throwing. That happens there. I think there was enough, it didn't get nominated for other things, that people are also, not for nothing, voters saw this movie. They did.
Yes.
Yep. Yeah. And I think the message is, it feels like it's saying something and yet doesn't say too much. And I'm not trying to critique the movie. That's not what I'm doing here. But it's just kind of the right amount of social commentary without being
it's feminism 101. Yeah,
plus it was fun and people like Margot Robbie, and that's got a big thing from Ryan Gosling, and people have good feelings toward Gerwig, like, and it made a bunch of money, and that, and Oppenheimer was the defibrillator to the Hollywood ecosystem last summer, and I think people know that. So I think Barbie will win. That's my guess.
I think that's a good guess. I've kind of been trying to reverse engineer my way into it, and I think we can knock the zone of interest out of contention, because the first threshold that a film has to cross to win this is that people have to see it.
People have
and
to see it.
This is the toughest sell. The zone of interest is the toughest sell on this list because it's the hardest one to watch in several ways. It is the most artistically challenging, and the subject matter is the most challenging. Barbie is the polar opposite of that. More people saw that than saw any movie this year, and I think we should assume the same of Academy voters. I think Scorsese or Nolan is going to get Best Director. I think Oppenheimer is going to get Best Picture.
I do too.
And I was doing the same. Maybe Barbie will win because this is a place where voters can throw it a bone. You made a great point in your deep dives that, though, sometimes, like, the feel-good pick, and not because the movie makes you feel good, but because you get to feel good for voting for it, will win Best Adapted Screenplay. And I think there's a notch there for American Fiction. It's a great movie. and an academy that is primarily composed of white people get to feel good about themselves for voting for what is a good movie and is also a commentary on race relations and the creation of art. I think
here's a meta thought. If American fiction wins for adapted screenplay, does that prove that it's wrong? That like we've moved on from the thing Everett's created was critiquing now 20 years ago, right? Like what would we say about the critique of this? Like, you know, has the hegemon fully come and absorbed the inherent critique of American fiction? Because Yellowface is not making dissimilar points than American fiction.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like Yellowface, to me, I felt the bite of that a little bit more. Now, again, it's been a long time since I've read Erasure, and you're right that I think a little bit of the edge was sanded off for American fiction.
Yeah.
But there's a part to me, it's like, what a tremendous irony would it be for it to win the award as it's critiquing the largely white... I mean, the other thing that's different here is like than some of these is this is critiquing white liberalism as much as it's critiquing anything else, right?
So I don't think American fiction winning would mean that problem has ended, if anything.
No, it's not like, the problem, but like, did we get the point of it if the Academy gives it the award? Did you fully get the joke if you actually give it the Academy? I mean, I know it's kind of a funny idea.
It is a funny idea. It is a funny question. Like, we've seen how white the bestseller lists remain.
Yes.
So this problem persists, but American fiction winning for this would potentially be a thing that people would hold up in the same way that they held up Obama winning the presidency as like evidence that we have reached some magical post-racial existence. I think there's a lot of affection for American fiction. It's a really good movie. And in a year where Oppenheimer and Killers of the Flower Moon didn't come out, it would have had a much bigger chance at Best Picture. But like, Cillian Murphy and Bradley Cooper are going to duke it out for Best Actor. There's no room for Jeffrey Wright here. And Ryan Gosling might get it for Barbie. I think that would be a travesty, but it could happen.
I don't know. I think Wright has a chance. I think, we're also in the who's seen what here. Is American Fiction the second least seen movie? Do you think more people have seen Poor Things or American Fiction? I would almost certainly say Poor Things because of Emma Stone and that the weirdness of it. And RuPaul.
Yeah, I don't.
Bigger
stars.
I don't
know. That's a good question. I should have looked up their box office takes going into this. You know, I think there's a chance though that like Cillian Murphy, that's a wonderful performance in Oppenheimer. Yeah. Bradley Cooper is very explicitly, overtly talking about how desperately he wants an Oscar and has been forever. Everybody knows this, though, that Bradley Cooper is thirsty for an Oscar. He is not going to win Best Picture for Maestro. He is not going, like, that's not going to happen here. And I could see the bone tossing going the direction of Bradley Cooper gets to win Best Actor.
Not going to happen. He's got the Hathaway stink on him right now. No one likes that. It's not fair.
I like Hathaway a lot more
than him. I think for a lot of this Hathaway stuff, I also didn't like his performance in Maestro. I thought it was weird. There was something uncanny about what's going on there. So I don't know. I think most people who if they have affection for American fiction, it means they probably haven't seen it. It's easier to have. I think they have affection for Jeffrey Wright, though.
Yeah, he's wonderful.
Now, again, this is not his fifth rodeo, right? He hasn't had a lot of leading person chances.
Paul Giamatti, how
much there is, it's his turn stuff.
Yeah, and Paul Giamatti won the Golden Globe for Best Actor for The Holdovers, and that was it's time for Paul Giamatti to win a thing. Let's do it.
Yeah, I think Giamatti is a much more interesting it's time case, even though Paul Giamatti is playing Paul Giamatti in The Holdover, the movie, which I liked.
Yeah.
But I liked him as Paul Giamatti better in Sideways,
but
myself.
I think the existence of Cillian Murphy, Bradley Cooper, and Paul Giamatti means that Jeffrey Wright is less likely to win Best Actor for American Fiction. And so American Fiction stays in contention for the, like, we want to toss American Fiction something in a year where the field is really crowded. I think a point for Poor Things is that it's weird, but it's not inaccessibly weird. You get to feel artsy for getting it.
Yeah.
Emma Stone is incredible. But Emma Stone is not likely to win Best Actress here because Lily Gladstone is set up to make history for Killers of the Flower Moon, and she should. And so Poor Things also going to be suffering for having to compete in the year where Oppenheimer comes out, especially. So this could be a bone that gets thrown to Poor Things for this. So I don't know. I've narrowed it down to...
I was going to say, are you going to make a pick or what? How long are we going to do this dithering before you actually tell me who you think is going to win, Rebecca? Come on. I came right out the gate and said Barbie, and so
I know.
Now is the time.
I think Barbie is probably the most likely. I would like to see
probably
it go
the
to...
most likely. Could you communicate a little more? Would you like to throw another adverb in there? It's just a podcast. We can go.
I can dither. Have you welcome to podcasting? What yeah. we
You're
dither.
Not generally that much of a ditherer though. That's why it's notable.
I know. I liked all of these. I think American Fiction or Poor Things probably. I think one of those should win. Barbie. I won't be surprised if Barbie wins. I also won't be super disappointed. I don't know. I feel very torn. There was good stuff about so many of these, and the field is so crowded that it is like four-dimensional chess thinking about what the Academy voters might be doing.
Maybe cutting the Gordian knot may start here. Do you think it's an Oppenheimer tsunami? Because it could be, right, where it just sort of wins in every category. This happens sometimes, and you just get all the awards. Because I think that's the other way of going. I think if it's Barbie, it's probably Oppenheimer, and because it's a tsunami. And I also think, again, I haven't read them all and I haven't seen them all, but I have seen a bunch of biopics in my life and most of them are bad. And this one is not only not bad, it's excellent and it does many hard things simultaneously. I think Oppenheimer should win. If it was up to me, Oppenheimer would win, would win this. I think American Fiction is good. I think the book does most of the work. I do not think American Prometheus does most of the work. It has a lot of, it's like a Lego set versus just a bunch of Legos in a huge box. And I feel like Oppenheimer's a little bit more of that. Like, you got to figure out what to do and how to frame it. Complicated ideas. Like, I just think it's a wonderful achievement in selection, historical telling, psychology, and movie making. And the screenplay, I think, does a lot of that work, frankly, and more than I realized when I first saw it. Because, like, it's kind of overwhelming in its own way. But there's a lot of ways to get that wrong. A lot of bad ways to get that wrong.
Oh,
we've seen
bad
biopic after bad biopic with stories easier to tell than that.
From the degree of difficulty angle, it's Oppenheimer or Poor Things, I think, in terms of like what took the most work to turn that book into a thing that you can see on screen and enjoy.
I'd love to have an opinion. That's
I would love for you to have an opinion too. Yeah. I would love to talk with you about Poor Things. Oh, can I just dither?
What do you mean? You are dithering. You can't ask permission to do anything that's currently in process.
You know, here's the thing, though. I don't want it to be an Oppenheimer sweep. Oppenheimer is a very, very like technically accomplished film. I do think we're going to refer to it for years for the things that Christopher Nolan achieved with it. But I'm also just kind of over the Christopher Nolan thing. And it's hard for me to get out of the way of that. I would give it to Poor Things. In my heart, I think that's where it goes.
I might be biased against it now because it doesn't like the things I like the best about the book, which is this metatextual literary playfulness stuff. If you don't do that, I'm like, okay, so you're like, again, I need to see the movie to see what is done in place of that or in response to, or does it share the same spirit of, but like a big chunk of the book for me, much like the big chunk of the Cervantes thing, is this metatextual stuff. Like, I don't know what to do with that myself.
Yeah, I think it's one of those where that like familiarity with the source text might be a hurdle where our assumption, our working assumptions about the Academy is that folks are not familiar with the source text. And Poor Things works great having not read the book. So I think I would go there.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's sort of the game. Like just looking at some of the past, I was like, is there any, can you look at historical precedent? And notably among award sort of bodies, NBCC, or no, sorry, whatever the film critics.
Motion Academy.
BAFTA.
Academy of Motion Picker.
Producers, Golden Globes. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's an equivalent category in any of those. So it's hard to read tea leaves. There's no tea to be read. When it comes to adapted, it's unique among the awards bodies, and that'd be an interesting. I wonder if there's a story there about why this category came to exist. Was it there initially? Why do this? There was some desire to separate original from adapted, but why? Who it was a sot to whom? Maybe it was a sot to Orson Welles or somebody, I don't know. You know, so
of the category would be useful.
Did someone over at MGM get super pissed that The Wizard of Oz wasn't nominated in Best Screenplay? And they're like, okay, we'll create a category for you. Or maybe they were pissed because it was, and I don't know. I'm sure there's a story there.
Yeah,
it's kind of a fascinating wrinkle.
Yeah, you can imagine a version of the conversation that's like, well, this thing that's based on a book, especially if it's a really faithful adaptation to the book, that's not as hard as writing an original screenplay.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I'm not sure what people would say. And in some ways, I think it could be easily as difficult. I mean, this is not my terrain at all.
I think some of the tension that I feel with this is similar to the tension that we talk about with the National Book Awards. Like, more categories, please.
Yeah.
We need more categories more desperately in books, because there are just so very many more books by orders of magnitude than there are movies in a given year. But ways to make additional distinctions, like some sort of genre separation would be interesting, or something. A best debut would be really interesting to see. And also, this is just a really crowded field. There are years where this conversation wouldn't have been nearly as dithery.
No, that's right. Well, and you know what else is weird is that if you went back and reround the universe, and we lived in a world in which there was no adapted screenplay category, I don't think people would be clamoring for it.
Oh yeah, I agree.
Yeah. On the other hand, now that we have it, it makes me want a best performance based on a real person category. I've always wanted that. Because I think, you know, the Austin Butlers of the world, the Elvises of the world, like the Rami Maleks, like...
Yeah, it's a different kind of work.
I get people like that. I don't particularly care for that myself. I find it always strange to put in the teeth and try to act like someone who's already existed. But this would also be a murderer's row year, too, because you have Lily Gladstone and Cooper, and I guess probably Annette Bening would go in that for Naiad, which is a movie that... is not bad, but there's a way more interesting movie in that story of Naiad.
Yes.
But that's a conversation for a different day.
The movie that they did make does not belong in the best picture category, in my opinion.
Jodie Foster was amazing.
Opinion.
I forgot how much.
Jodie Foster is the best part of that
She's
movie.
She's terrific. I've always liked Jodie Foster. I mean, I know this is not an unusual take, but I remember my affection for Jodie.
It was so nice to see her. And she's just becoming this very. She's always been potent, but Jodie Foster now in her 60s is this very distilled version of Jodie Foster that is so enjoyable. And I think Annette Bening and Naiad, those are great performances, but that's not the it's not the most interesting story that you could have told with that film. Mm-hmm. And it was an interesting choice to put it in there for Best Picture.
Okay. Well, let's see who wins. I don't know. I mean, it's probably going to be like the Zone of Interest and be like, what?
I will be so surprised.
Yeah.
And I guess I'll just say it now. If the Zone of Interest wins Best Adapted Screenplay, my working assumption will be most people didn't see it. They just voted for it because that is like, this is very, it's a topic that's in the news right now. And that does happen sometimes.
That would be your biggest surprise. There you go. That's what we can get out on this. You didn't make a pick. You thought what you wanted and you can get out on what will surprise you.
Like, I am confident that Zone of Interest is the movie that the fewest people have seen on this list. And it's the hardest to watch. And there is a way where, whether it's about the Holocaust or something that's currently in the news or not, there are folks who are like, that sounds like the one I should vote for. So here we go. I can understand how it would happen, but it would be very surprising based on, you know, all the rest of it, especially this year.
When are we going to get the Undoing Project? I was thinking, because way up on my list, I like maybe you tipping my hand when I talk about Social Network and Oppenheimer. I feel like I have the most affection for these adapted screenplays that take real stories and put them together in a way that makes sense for that story, but the book itself didn't have it. Like Moneyball is the example I think about. I read that, I was like, I cannot see this as a movie. Sorkin did an unbelievable job with that screenplay. And again, took some liberties with some things to trim it down. But there's a version of The Undoing Project that's Tversky and Kahneman friendship.
Yeah.
Plus like, the ideas, plus the Oppenheimer kind of things happening,
taking like walks in the park,
uncovering. Yeah,
talking about ideas, just like looking at the results of their research, and then little clips of them like giving lectures and winning the Nobel.
Someone could have a field day with trying to represent cognitive or behavioral psychology on film. It's like they're trying to do this. It would be cool. Oh, someone could do something awesome.
Yeah, I think
awesome
that's a
that.
Great, it would be like a great montage scene of the different kinds of experiments they conducted. Yeah.
Yeah, you could see The Big Short, like those interstitial things, mm-hmm, which mm-hmm. I kind of go back and forth on sometimes, like, oh yeah, Bourdain. And I'm like, oh yeah, Robbie. It's like, that's a little whatever at this point. Yeah. But where you kind of do side breaks or, I don't know, there's something fun in that. But you could have, you could eat with that particular screenplay mm-hmm. if done.
I mean, it's Michael Lewis.
The Tversky role would be unbelievable for something.
That'll get made, I'm sure.
Are you sure?
It's Michael Lewis.
If here's what. If Poor Things can get made, anything can get made.
Truly.
Yeah. All right, let's end on that.
Yeah.
Bookriot.com/listen. You can find the show notes there. The deep dive. I guess it's the thing we reference the most. The Patreon is there as well. Rebecca's Better Living Through Books. And we'll see where the Oscar goes. Thanks, Rebecca. This was fun.
Thank you. It was fun.